Hello and welcome to the Oldie podcast with me, Harry Mount, editor of the Oldie. And in this month's edition, spring edition, we've got a fantastic article by Joshua Levine on the centenary of the RAF and the newly refurbished RAF Museum in Hendon. Joshua Levine is a distinguished author, the author of Fighter Heroes of World War I, and last year, Dunkirk, the history behind the major motion picture. Now, Joshua, 1st of April is the centenary of the founding of the RAF, which a lot of our listeners will find strange. It was founded in 1st of April 1918, towards the end of the war. Why was that?
Well, that's absolutely right. Basically, the RAF was formed out of two distinct organisations. One was the Royal Flying Corps, which was the army branch of the flying service. The other was the Royal Naval Air Service. And these had broken apart, basically, slightly before the First World War. So you had these two distinct entities that actually weren't working together particularly. I mean, they, in some places they did, but they were also in competition for engines, for parts. They, you know, their communication wasn't particularly good. And it was decided towards the end of the war to bring them together, specifically because there was going to be a large strategic bombing campaign on Germany. And the idea was to bring these branches together so they could actually work together to attack the enemy as one. So that was the thinking of bringing them together in 1918. And in fact, it was, well, depending on how you look at it, it was either the first independent air force, independent meaning separate from the other armed forces, separate from the army.
Except for Finland.
Well, this is it. I mean, Finland did get there a few weeks earlier, but they only had one aircraft and one person to fly it. So, you know, does that count? You decide. But anyway, so the RAF was there 1st of April 1918, April Fool's Day, and this will be the 100th anniversary. So it's a big day, and the RAF Museum is going to attempt to mark that anniversary by bringing in quite a few new exhibits, so we can maybe talk about that later.
Sure. And obviously 1918, it's only just over a decade since the first manned flight. Mm. So you have this sudden rush in the build-up to the First World War, is that right? Because you talk about the Hendon Aerodrome, which is where the Hendon Museum is, and this man called Claude Graham White. Yeah. Can you tell us the story of how this second-hand car dealer became an instrumental figure in the founding of the Hendon Aerodrome and the RAF?
Well, if you think about it, flying in its early days was the sort of thing that daredevils did. It was a sort of, it was a bit like Formula One. It was something that it wasn't open to most people. You came at it from two different angles. You were either a sort of techie. You were either fascinated by engines and by the way machines worked. Or you were a sort of daredevil who wanted to climb into a machine that would take you into the air, which, you know, quite extraordinary for the time. So there were these two types of people, and they were the ones who got involved in flying early on. And one man who saw the potential for this was Claude Graham White. Now, he was a car dealer. He had a car dealership in the centre of London. But he also had the eye to an opportunity. So he, in the very early days, he took an aircraft down to Field in Hendon, where some people had just started flying, and he flew around. He then went to America, took an aircraft to America, showed the Americans basically how aeroplanes work, landed at the White House, you know, took JFK's grandfather up for a flight, met a lot of women that way. It was quite a sexy thing to be doing, and also made money, and then came back to England and actually started a flying school on that field at Hendon. So he basically single-handedly got this place going, and he turned it into something that was significantly large. You know, significantly, there were enough people there.
One of the biggest aerodromes in Britain at this stage?
Well, at this stage, absolutely. But it was also very close to London. So when war broke out, it became, you know, an obvious point for the air services, that is the Royal Naval Air Service first, and then the Royal Flying Corps, both of them to congregate there, both of them. So, for example, you had Zeppelins flying over London, bombing London in the early part of the war. The authorities had to do something about that. So aeroplanes based at Hendon would go up and fly against the Zeppelins. And in fact, the first mission that went up, the first sortie was done by Claude Graham White when he was flying for the Royal Naval Air Service. And what you had really, so you had Hendon developing itself as not just civilian flying, not just a place where people could learn to fly, where there were also factories to make aeroplanes, but also as the base, really the base of military flying. And you had people, all these sorts of strange people who'd been involved in flying before the war, who then ended up going into the flying services. And so that made the flying services very different to the more traditional, to the army, to the navy, which had the discipline, which had the sense of continuity. These flying services, you know, where had they come from? They'd appeared almost overnight, and they were full of the sorts of people that probably wouldn't be welcomed into the more traditional, more conservative services.
And did that make them into a slightly ramshackle amateur outfit at the opening of the First World War?
Well, I think what made them slightly ramshackle was the fact that aeroplanes were in a very, very early state of development, and they couldn't do very much. So, you know, at the very beginning of the First World War, people didn't really know whether planes had a role in warfare. There was a sort of vague idea because, you know, there'd been military trials. And in fact, there'd been one based at Hendon. But there'd been military trials where planes tried things out. So, you know, Claude Graham White had this military trial at Hendon, went up in the air and dropped large bags to show that they could bomb. And also they could carry out reconnaissance. You know, they could look down from a height, which, of course, in the First World War, when you were talking about going behind enemy lines, you know, the cavalry couldn't do that, people on foot couldn't do that, only aeroplanes could go behind enemy lines, look down, see what was going on, take photographs. So as time developed, they realised it was a role for aeroplanes, but the aeroplanes themselves were, at the beginning of the war, very, very basic.
You know, they're basically canvas and timber, aren't
they?
Yeah,
they were flying bird cages. They were so festooned with wires that, you know, they used to say you could keep a canary safely inside one. They were huge, and they were, you know, basically made of linen, were covered in linen. They had wooden structures, which, on the one hand, you know, they were so unreliable and they were so flimsy. On the other hand, if you crashed in one, you actually had a reasonable chance of walking away because the thing would crumple underneath you. So, you know, they were very, very basic. And the extraordinary thing about war is how quickly things developed. So you went from 1914, where these machines were very basic. I mean, when the Royal Flying Corps flew out to France at the beginning of the war, the engines were very unreliable, so they were told, everyone was told, congregated at Dover, people died on the flights to Dover from their various starting points.
But the planes collapsed?
The planes just crashed. I mean, the engines cut out, and the main problem early on was unreliable engines. And for that reason, they were told, when you're crossing the channel from Dover to France, from Swingate Downs over to Amiens, get up to 3,000 feet before you cross the channel, because you will then be able to glide over the channel if your engine cuts out. Because let me tell you, if you landed in the channel, that was it. No one was coming to pick you up. So it was, that's how precarious it was. And in the very first days of the First World War, you had these pilots going out trying a bit of reconnaissance to see whether they could do it. And there's a story of one pilot coming back, having seen large, because of course at the beginning of the First World War, it was a mobile war, it wasn't yet a war of trenches. And you've got this one pilot who goes out on the very first reconnaissance and you know, sees almost nothing, comes back, gets lost. And then a few days later, somebody goes up and actually sees large movements of German troops. And he comes back down, and the head of the Air Force, a man at the time called Henderson, takes him immediately to see John French, who's, you know, the big boss.
Yeah.
And he sits there in front of John French. He says, "Sir, this is what I've seen." And he tells him all about what he's seen. And French says, "Ah, that's very nice, but I'm afraid you can't have seen what you think you've seen, because we have other information that shows otherwise. But tell me about an aeroplane. Does it go very high? Is it cold?" And he was just patronised to pieces by French. Actually, he was completely right about what he'd seen. And over a period of time, the generals started to put faith in the aeroplane, and it actually found itself a role. And
by the end of the war, 1918, you bring up in your excellent article the Red Baron, famous mm-hmm. Baron von Richthofen, was killed in April 1918, two a century ago. And by the end, there really are these very sophisticated dogfights, is that right?
Yeah, well, dogfights started relatively early on, but in the early days, they tended to be one person following another closely. Not unlike Star Wars, actually, when you see the TIE fighters and the X, whatever they're called. But by the end of the war, you had machines going much more quickly. They were much more powerful and much more heavily armed. They saw each other in much more fleeting dogfights. So you'd have large melees of large groups. You'd have heavy bombing raids, large-scale industrial bombing raids. You know, when the war ended, we were a few days from a large-scale raid on Berlin. You know, they got. Do you know what they were doing at the beginning of the war? They were dropping darts, feather darts, over the side of the plane. Very horrible if you were underneath one. But you know, this was hardly. There was not the atomic bomb. So if you look
at Britain was being bombed as well.
And Britain was
Scarborough was bombed, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, a lot of London. If you walk around London and you see bomb damage, you automatically assume that it's Second World War bomb damage. But actually, a lot of the bomb damage is First World War, either from Zeppelins in the first part of the war or Gotha bombers, large bombers in the second part. So, for example, Lincoln's Inn, if you walk in stone buildings, Lincoln's Inn, very beautiful area, there's a huge amount of bombing, all First World War. If you go by the embankment, Cleopatra's Needle, that's First World War bombing. I mean, a lot of this was, and people panicked as well. There was a great fear during the First World War that bombing would start this sort of conflagration that would end mankind. And part of this, I mean, people had written about it. H.G. Wells had written just before the war about the possibility of society coming to an end because of bombing. And people were genuinely panicked. They also, they took shelter in tube stations during the First World War. So when it happened in the Second World War, that wasn't unprecedented. People were going down because they'd remembered doing it previously.
And it's interesting, we've all heard of the Red Baron. You obviously know a lot of First World War British pilots. I couldn't name one until I read your article. Why is the Red Baron so famous and there isn't a British equivalent in popular knowledge?
I think the Red Baron became... I think he became a sort of bogeyman because he's quite sort of... He's almost like a baddie from a piece of fiction. You know, his red aeroplane... it looked evil with its three levels of wings, and because he was the highest scoring pilot of the war, and because he had this sort of aura about him that he was invincible. He wasn't, because he was shot down in April 1918, breaking one of his own rules. I mean, he'd actually just issued a set of rules, and one of his rules was don't fly low over enemy territory, and he died doing precisely that.
He was shot from the ground, is that right?
Yes, he was shot by a machine gun from the ground. And for many years, it was thought that a Canadian pilot called Brown had shot him down flying from behind, but actually, it seems from where he was shot and the angle and what happened. But he was already incredibly famous at the time. I mean, troops were on the scene, British troops, or Allied troops were on the scene within moments. They picked his plane clean, like vultures. And you still get bits of his plane appearing on eBay. If you added up all these bits of Red Baron's plane, you'd actually have something, the size of a jumbo jet. It's thousands of them. So don't buy them, my advice. But he was already a hugely well-known figure. But you see, there were also British... Well, the British authorities basically didn't want to encourage celebrity amongst their pilots. They didn't want people to become famous. And the reason was they felt that the actual real work the pilots were doing wasn't, attacking each other in the sky. That was a kind of side issue. It was doing the work, the reconnaissance, artillery observation, in other words, guiding the guns onto enemy positions. These were the jobs, the day-to-day work that the aeroplanes were there to do, essentially to help the army on the ground and to bomb. So it was a bit of a red herring to make heroes out of these fighter pilots. What they were doing was basically trying to keep the air clear for the other airmen to do their job, the unglamorous jobs. But, of course, people needed heroes during the First World War. First World War was a mechanized war where everything happened at huge distances. Naval battles were far away from each other. There wasn't any of the sort of boarding ships you had in the Hornblower era. Unless you were going over the top, which was relatively rare, or doing a trench raid, the infantry didn't meet each other very often. So these gladiators of the air, who there was still some chivalry, where they were very close to each other as they were dogfighting, following each other, these became the heroes. So in Britain, for example, the first real hero was a man called William Leif Robinson, who shot down the first Zeppelin. He was the first person in 1916 to shoot down a Zeppelin, and he was given the Victoria Cross for it. Really, the reason he was able to shoot it down was because he'd been given incendiary ammunition. It was the first, you know, the first time. And when you shot this incendiary ammunition at a huge ball of gas, it blew up. But because he was seen as the saviour of Britain from this golem, this Zeppelin that was threatening the people, he was a hero. Babies were named after him. He became, you know, cigarette cards with his face. He became a great big hero. He was rewarded by being sent out to the Western Front with the first of a new aircraft, and he was shot down the first time out and died just after his release at the end of the war from pneumonia.
And to move on to the RAF Museum in Hendon, Britain's most famous RAF museum, it's opening in late June after a massive refit, and you've had a sneak preview of it. Can you tell us what it's like?
I have. It's very impressive. It's, you know, clearly a lot of thought's gone into it. And I think it's fair to say that the theme they've gone in for is that they're trying to tell the story of the Royal Air Force, which makes sense. It is the Royal Air Force Museum. In other words, in the past, sometimes, you know, they've tried to spread themselves too thinly by telling the story of flight. And I think they've decided, because of the very close connection between Hendon, which you could say is really, you know, the home of military flying, and the RAF, they should make it the story of the RAF. So, and the way they're trying to do that is by telling the story from the beginning through to the end. So, you know, it's going to be interactive, not, I suspect, in a sort of tacky or tacked on way, but in a way that you actually are going to be able to engage with the exhibitions. And it's going to tell the story not just of the centrepiece. It's going to tell the First World War, period between the wars. It's going to tell, obviously, you know, the Battle of Britain and Bomber Command. But it's also going to tell the period after, and it's going to have a large separate section on the period from the Falklands through to the present day. And what I could see, I mean, so it's not finished yet, but what I could see and what I was told is they're going to focus on four different distinct areas: attack, defence, prepare and support. So, you know, attacking will contain bombers and nuclear missiles, a feature on the development of bombs, and defence will be a Spitfire mock-up of the Battle of Britain operations table. Prepare will be to do with training. You'll have flight simulators where a visitor will be able to do a very first lesson, a genuine first lesson, which, you know, rather than just taking a simulator and not knowing what you're doing, you will be told what you are meant to be doing. And support will have things like the search and rescue helicopter flown by Prince William, which I think I'd be quite interested to see. So, you know, it promises much. My only fear, and it is a fear, is that they will, you know, too much emphasis will be drawn away from the centrepieces, the Battle of Britain.
Well, you do say, and I was worried by this, that they're dismantling the museum's Battle of Britain Hall.
Yeah, so there was a dedicated Battle of Britain Hall. And to be fair, you know, it's what a lot of people come to see. People come from across the world to see this. And of course they do, because it's, you know, it's iconic.
Deserves. And planes did fly from Hendon in the Battle.
Planes did fly, actually. And yes, one pilot, actually, there was a German bomber that was on course to hit Buckingham Palace, and a plane flying from Hendon actually knocked it out of the way. You know, this was a huge, this was probably the biggest story of the Battle of Britain at the time. And it's a guy called Ray Holmes, Sergeant Ray, a sergeant pilot, and he, you know, supposedly saved Buckingham Palace, and he did that from Hendon. So, you know, Hendon has a very close connection with the Battle of Britain, and we're all fascinated with it. We should be fascinated with it, because it's what saved Britain from invasion.
But so should we be worried that the Battle of Britain Hall has been dismantled?
Well, we should be concerned that sufficient emphasis is placed on this most important period of British history. I haven't seen enough to be able to say that, you know, they're not emphasizing it. I mean, they took pains to tell me that there will be lots of material on the Battle of Britain, but not in a dedicated area, rather within other areas. Now, let's wait and see.
Right. And we're talking, as Gary Oldman has just won an Oscar for playing Winston Churchill in Darkest Hour, and you wrote the very successful top 10 bestseller, Dunkirk, the history behind the major motion picture, which came out last year to go with the film. Why do you think there is this renewed interest in the Second World War particularly?
Well, I suppose there was, first of all, there was a lot of renewed interest in the First World War, with the 100th anniversary. And you could argue that it's time for the Second World War. I think we're coming to a point where people are dying out, and it's where living memory turns into history, and it's a moment where people suddenly say, "Oh my God, why didn't I listen to Grandpa? Why didn't I ask him what he did? Why didn't I pay more attention?" And I think we're slightly going through that at the moment. We're suddenly realizing we've taken for granted for years that there are lots of Battle of Britain pilots around. There's lots of people who were at D-Day around.
One left, is that right? Johnny Johnson?
Oh, no, he's the last of the Dambusters.
Oh, sorry.
There are still quite a few Battle of Britain pilots going. There's still quite a few. I mean, I just the other day met a rear gunner on a Lancaster who survived 38 operations, and you know, he's after the war he started a kitchen shop. You know, these people had to live. They didn't spend their whole lives as rear gunners on Lancasters, and you know, they are still amongst us, and we really have to pay attention to those that we have left. And I think there is a kind of sense that we're losing this period now, and we've got to, you know, look closer at it. And I think, you know, in terms of, you know, I worked on the Dunkirk film. I was the historical consultant on it. And I found it absolutely, you know, together with the director, we went to meet Dunkirk veterans, some of whom even in the last year have died. And it was absolutely extraordinary. I know he was very moved by it.
Christopher Nolan, this is, yeah.
And I also know that he, you know, I've got clips of interviews that we did with these people. So we went to see one man, for example, who was a beachmaster at Dunkirk. And he told us how he watched people, more than one person, walking out into the sea, just committing suicide, basically. I say committing suicide, who knows what was in their head, whether they just simply, you know, had enough and didn't know what they were doing, whether they genuinely thought they could swim to England, you know, who knows. But he told it very movingly, and Christopher Nolan put that straight into the film. So, you know, I've got the clip of the man talking, who's since died, and then you can just look at the clip of it translated into the film. Now, that is the effect that it had on Christopher Nolan. And it's why, ultimately, the important thing is to listen to these people while they're still around, because they can tell it not through our modern-day filter, our political filter, or our social filter, how we would like to remember it, how it was to them. And that's not to say they don't disagree with each other. You know, these people will disagree totally about what it was like, but we've got to listen to them. I mean, I met one man, Royal Engineer, who had... His experience of Dunkirk was to arrive on the beach with his friends. There were no boats, so he went back behind the beaches, where he found a restaurant open. And the restaurant was serving, and he had champagne. He was an ordinary bloke from Britain, never had champagne before, tried it, loved it, decided, you know, I'm going to spend the rest of my life drinking this. And they got, you know, tipsy, and then went onto the beach where a boat came in. They were able to go straight on, and they came straight back. His memory of Dunkirk was basically a nice day out. Now, he's not typical, but at the same time, you know, isn't it great that we have his memory? Because, my goodness me, these things are not straightforward. They're nuanced, they're complex, and we've got to remember them in all their messy complication.
That's an extremely good place to end this interview with Joshua Levine, And I'm very grateful to him for appearing on the Oldie podcast, and I'm very grateful to him for his brilliant article in the spring issue of the Oldie about the centenary of the RAF. Thanks so much, Josh.
Thank you, Harry.